Hello everyone, welcome to the Under 30 Chit Chat, where we talk to Forbes Middle East 30 Under 30 listers who are changing the world around them and shaping the future of the region. I'm Layana Bushkayer, here with Sasha Haider, a partner at Global Ventures and one of our 2022 listers. Thanks for being with us, Sasha.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Sasha, you have a really inspiring and a very long journey when it comes to venture capital and your work in investing in other companies. I would like to start by asking you about the beginning of where everything has begun. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, where you started, how your story has started?
Yeah, I'm super happy to tell you a little bit about that. It actually started really, really far away from venture capital.
I know that.
Finance was definitely not something where I saw myself, or a space where I saw myself working. But essentially, I mean, you know, right from the very beginning, and I think this is quite important to my story, you know, I was born in the UK. My family's originally from Pakistan, and I grew up here, and I'm second generation, and here being the UAE. Mm-hmm. I'm second generation in the UAE. My father also grew up here. And so that just led very much to being this very confused person for the first half of my life, mainly because I didn't really know which box I was supposed to fit into. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that, you know, I think stays true and has like followed me since then is the narrative of around the Global South. So I was like consistently in environments where I was essentially asked to pick, you know, which part of my personality I affiliated the most with. Was it the Pakistani side? Was it the part that came from Dubai? Was it the part that, you know, was linked to the UK where my mother's family was? And I think that was a consistent struggle for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that growing up, I found that my greatest strength lies in all three of those things, which is, you know, being able to say like, I'm comfortably, you know, British, Pakistani, and from the UAE to the extent that that makes sense to other people. And essentially, I think that's like really what's guided me throughout my career in terms of like what I want to do and what excites me. Mm-hmm. And specifically telling the stories and raising the narrative about the Global South. And you'll, you know, we'll chat about it a little bit more in detail later, but also living in Latin America and Kenya and then being from this part of the world. I really feel like the one thing that I noticed across my time there is like how similar, you know, people in these markets are, not just the demographics and at the macro level, but also in terms of just, you know, how people are, the culture. And so that's been something that's always been really central to my journey. Mm-hmm. But when I, you know, growing up here, I always thought I wanted to be a news anchor. Oh. Which now is kind of hilarious, considering the fact that I'm actually not entirely very comfortable in front of the camera. And so I interned the summer before I graduated from high school at CNN. And I was set on doing history and politics at university, which is what I studied. And I really thought I'm going to be, you know, the next Hala Gorani or, you know, whoever would, you know, at the time was, you know, super exciting. And I spent a lot of, you know, I did a lot of really exciting things that summer. I ran the teleprompter for like the live news with Stan Grant. And I think the one thing that I learned during all that time was that, you know, journalism is an incredibly competitive environment, which I'm sure you can speak to. And honestly, at the time, from what I understood from all of my, you know, my mentors and managers there, not very well paid. it's the second half of it. And I think that that was sort of my initial taste around like, this is really hard. It's going to take me a while to climb up the ladder. And I, you know, probably won't have a lot of funds to my name if I do this for some time, being the kind of maybe narrow-minded 18-year-old that I was. And then the summer before I graduated, you know, I was given the opportunity to intern at the private equity arm of Louis Vuitton in Singapore, then L Capital Asia, now L Catterton. And there I worked as part of the value creation team for their, you know, strategy, which was essentially investing in companies such as Charles & Keith, Batil, Jones the Grocer, brands that, you know, you might be well acquainted with. And, you know, essentially working on how we expand them, how we increase the investment's value, and then, you know, a path to exit eventually. And I was working with two veterans from, you know, one from Louis Vuitton and one from Duty Free in Milan. And essentially I got this like amazing sort of front row experience to retail, merchandising, and how to sort of like increase a company's value. But I also realized that it probably wouldn't make sense for me to do that until I had a bit of like, hands-on retail experience or some type of like, you know, operational experience myself. And in tandem, they were raising and closing a $1 billion fund at that time, which was fairly monumental. And I think I started to get a little bit interested and spend a bit of time with the investment team and said, how can I start doing this? I'm interested in the analysis. I'm interested in what it takes to make a good investment. And sort of that was like my first foray or entry into the world of investing. And the one thing that I will say is like, I tried many different things when I was, you know, between the ages of like 17 to 21, I interned at like 5 or 6 different companies.
Oh, wow.
And the one, you know, piece of unsolicited advice I'd give people listening to this is doing work experience teaches you not necessarily what you like, but it specifically helps you filter out what you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was sort of like through a process of trial and error that I kind of came to private equity, venture, or sort of investing. And I said, this is interesting.
That's really interesting, Sasha, because I really like that you mentioned the idea of, you know, trying different things and figuring out, you know, your way into life. And especially that, as you mentioned, you were not into finance at all. And then you jumped, suddenly into this field. And as far as I know that after, you know, working with Alvi's private equity firm, you moved to Mexico City, where you also did a little bit, you know, work in finance and private equity, and then you moved to Dubai, but before Dubai, you had also an interesting break, where you went to study art history, which is also interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about this period? Why did you decide, you know, to jump from finance into this, you know, in studying art history, and how did you decide to come to Dubai and
do? So I'll take a step back. Actually, there's one bit of my journey that you missed out there, which was so right out of college, I ended up working for a large private equity group abroad, which is infamous for many different reasons. But I actually joined them first in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, started, you know, fresh out of university, started working in Kenya as my first job. And that was really the first time that I interacted with, you know, emerging markets in a work context, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in El Capital Asia, I was working in Singapore, but that was, you know, a little bit more aspirational and a bit more developed. And then sort of I really went into the most emerging economy, which was sub-Saharan Africa, living in Kenya, working across Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, and South Africa. And that was really my first foray around like, wow, the opportunity here is huge.
Yeah.
It's so fragmented. There is like such a green space for us to do something, sorry, white space even, for us to do something like really impressive. And I was working on large cap transactions. So that's transactions in the range of sort of $20 to $70 million on the continent. And what was really interesting during that time, and this is important because it comes back to my journey in venture a little bit later, was we would often get early stage companies who are past the seed stage, so, you know, Series A or even Series B, who are coming to us because there were really no avenues of funding. And this is back in 2015 on the continent. So essentially they were like, they would knock on any door, founders would knock on any door they could to access, you know, funding potentially. And so that was kind of my first taste of, there's like this opportunity or like a missing middle when it comes to fundraising. Because, you know, I was working for a private equity player. There were a lot of angel networks and sort of seed funds that had started to pop up. But then there was a sort of A-plus space where nothing was really happening. And that was like really an amazing experience for many different reasons. So both Kenya, and then from Kenya, I moved to Mexico City, as you mentioned. Just like living and working in an environment where you don't speak the language, it's not like native to you, it really pushes you out of your comfort zone. I think learning, number one, to like work with people who have like a different culture, pace of life, way of doing things is like a massive learning curve. And I think it kind of compounds and adds to that story I was telling you about, like, you know, finding comfort in the different parts and facets of my personality. It was sort of building in that, like, up that arsenal of experience with different cultures and different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Mexico, actually, I learned how to speak Spanish. And I feel like, you know, we're always told when we're younger that, you know, you learn your languages the best, you know, under the age of 10. And so I kind of initially, when I moved there, I was like, this is a lost cause. I'm never going to learn it. And then I was working really, really hard. And in the evenings, I'd take an Uber home. And every night with the Uber driver, I'd say, can you stay with me another 30 minutes? Because I really want to practice my Spanish.
Oh, wow.
Actually, all of the, and so I literally sat with these Uber drivers for like 30 minutes at the end of the day, and that's where I learned to speak
Spanish.
That's
such an interesting way of learning a language.
Arguably, my quality of my Spanish initially wasn't great, and I was consistently being like corrected by people. But it was like a really interesting way to learn.
I totally
agree. And learning that language, I would say in so many different ways, changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, you go from sort of one, when you first move to a new country, kind of trying to learn the language to do the basic things like order food, do your groceries, like tell your cab where to go, be able to tell your cab when it's going in the wrong direction. And then suddenly you're like sitting in an airport and you can hear and understand the kind of peripheral conversations around you, which previously would have sounded like nothing. So I think that was like another like really important part of my journey, was just like having this opportunity and this experience to go and live abroad and you know, really interact with different cultures and work with different cultures. On the art history side of things, so I'd been working in private equity for like around 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had come to the end of my tenure in Latin America, and it was for a couple of different reasons. I think one was like personal, which was, you know, most of my friends, family, social networks are in this part of the world. So EMEA, so Europe and the Middle East and Africa. And also, to a certain extent, I just felt that I was not leveraging my network to the best of my abilities, given the, you know, like the, in a way that could help my corporate progression as well. So essentially, I was there and I found that, you know, while I spoke Spanish, while I had integrated really well, while I worked with lovely people, essentially, like being a non-Mexican woman in the room was a disadvantage in some ways, because there was always a bit of prior context with my peers, you know, that it was, you know, their friend or their cousin or someone that they'd known for some time. And so I always found myself as kind of still the stranger in the room, despite like how much I tried to integrate. And so then I kind of said, you know what, I've had a really intense few years of working. I've learned a lot, and some good lessons and some tough lessons, and definitely many things that influence the way I think about team management now. And learning also. But, you know, I was kind of like, I'm ready to, you know, take, you know, like, you know, quit. And then I think at that time, I was also just like, I'm not in a rush to do the next thing. And so I decided, you know, I've been working so hard for the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of my career. I think it's time I took a time out and I have like a little break. Because in the big scheme of things, when you work for 40 years of your life or 40 years plus, God knows, taking out 6 months is like not a big deal. But I think that, you know, when you first are starting your career, that seems like massive to take a break. And so I decided that I was just going to do something for myself entirely. And so I, you know, it's always been my passion, history. I studied it in university, something, you know, I'm personally really, really interested in. And I've always wanted to spend a bit more time on art history. So I went to Florence and I started, you know, a course at the British Institute in Florence studying art history. And at the time it was just me and a group of sort of over 60-year-old Americans, which was like an amazing environment. I was in bed every night by 10 p.m. but yeah, it was super interesting. And I feel like I just came back to the region following that, just like really energized, because I'd felt like I'd properly taken some time for myself and I'd expanded my horizons in a different way and I'd fed my soul a bit. And yeah, I came back to the region at the end of 2019 and started working at Global a few weeks later, which I feel like the universe sends you things.
Since you're speaking about, you know, universe sent you things, when you came here, you met Noor Sweet, who actually offered you a job to become part of the Global Ventures, where you are working now, and where you became the youngest female partner at a venture capital firm in the entire region. So can you tell us about, you know, that coincidence of meeting Noor? How has this, you know, directed the way maybe of you doing things today and your entry into Global Ventures?
Yeah, no, I'd love to tell you about that. I think that when you come from a more traditional corporate finance background, I think that that's usually what you seek, because it, you know, I felt like I'm moving region. The easiest thing to do would be to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I started to look around the market, and it was like very much I was interviewing with a certain fund regionally, and I was doing a case study on supermarket chains as part of my interview process. Mm-hmm. And I pulled together a model and I was sort of discussing everything. I was in an interview and I was discussing, I don't know, the SKUs of a supermarket, right? And I was just sitting in that interview and I really had this feeling to myself, wow, this is so boring. Like, I've really got this opportunity now. I'm fortunate enough to have this opportunity now to really re-pivot, you know, the way I think about my career and what I want to do next. And I'm sitting here doing this really boring thing and I should really try something new. And so, funnily enough, I was introduced by a family friend to Noor within the context of this. You know, Noor is an inspirational woman. She runs, like, and this is what they shared with me. I didn't actually know her before I was introduced to her. And it's like, she's a really inspirational woman, which I can obviously confirm now. but also she runs a venture capital firm here, or has the mindset closest to a Silicon Valley investor, mm-hmm. was what was she, like what I was told. And then they said, you know, she's someone who could potentially help you navigate the next stage of your career. Maybe she'll give you some ideas. At the time, I wasn't like super clued in on venture. I mean, I obviously knew it as like another asset in investing. And I met Noor, at a coffee shop, and we started chatting and she was running me through all the exciting things that she was working on. She just raised her debut fund. And she said about, 10 minutes into the conversation, she said, well, why don't you come and see what we're working on and see if that's interesting to you? Because she was like, I think that your structural investing experience could be really helpful to us. And so I really joined on a whim. It was one of those really weird things where I even said to her, I was like, is this how people get jobs now? I was like, I'm used to that 15-stage process. You interview with like 6 different people. You have to do like at least like 1 or 2 case studies. You know, it's not just like you rock up and someone's like, hey, join me and tell me what you think. And so I joined at the company's first offsite, which was literally like 10 people sat in, an offshoot of Noor's house, like in one of the rooms. So it was very, very much the beginning. And it was just like, it was an incredible experience. I felt like there was an opportunity to be creative, to build from the ground up. And, we always joke that Global Ventures, when we started, was a startup itself. So essentially, like as the founding team, like I won't compare our journey to that of the founders, because I know what they do is really, really difficult. But it was really the opportunity to sort of build from ground zero. And, I'm really, really fortunate to have been a part of that experience.
Absolutely. But when you entered into Global Ventures, as you mentioned, you were very young. You were the youngest, I think, woman doing that. And you were also a woman. And in the region, working with startups. So it's just, all the signs of complications, if I may call it that way. So can you tell us about, the challenges that you have faced first when you entered into doing this, or the opportunities that you've seen?
Yeah. So I would argue that like in a more traditional format, which is like private equity that I was doing before, being a young female presents, more challenges, and there's like a really clear hierarchy in how you grow through that hierarchy, right? I think in venture, it's like a lot more meritocratic and, flat. And so because of that, initially when I joined at Global, like I don't think I suffered or had any issues or challenges when it came to sort of integrating or like interacting with founders, et cetera, because I was, one of the many cogs, in a bigger machine, right? I think that over time, as I started to build my experience and build my profile a bit until I became a partner in 2022. Mm-hmm. Yes, you did. I have to remember. Actually, like when I started working at Global Ventures, until now, I don't think that being a woman has been a challenge in itself. I think that there are like many other challenges you do have to navigate as a young woman in the workforce. But I mean, I was working at a firm where two of the partners were female. And now I think like increasingly we were chatting a little bit before, we're seeing, significant gender parity and many female partners across venture firms in the UAE. So working in private equity, which was, a lot more hierarchical and, the very, very male dominated, I think that environment actually was a lot more difficult to navigate as a woman, but the path to growth was very clear and fairly structured. Like venture comparatively is like very meritocratic. And I think that, I was fortunate to build my experience over, the first few years, getting acquainted with the market, meeting founders, spending time on some investments before I became a partner in early 2022. And I think that I wouldn't necessarily say that it was being a female or being, a young a young partner that were challenges individually, but I think combined, there were some instances where I personally felt like, you know, I had, you know, a few roadblocks and I had to work my way around them. So an example of that for is, you know, I'm now a board member and I sit on the boards of many of our portfolio companies. And I think the first time I took on a board role, I was sort of surrounded in a room of, you know, significantly older men. I was the only female on the board. And I was really, and this is like an internal thing. I think I really felt like I need to prove why I deserve to be here. And I feel like that mindset was something that was to a certain extent self-inflicted. And I started going down the path of how do I compete with this person who has 10 more years of work experience than me? And that was like a very dangerous path to start down.
Absolutely.
And I think that's through time, what I've actually understood is it's a lot more about perspective rather than time and years of experience. Those things are definitely very valuable and very valid. But I think I have to always approach things. And now, like, my learning is that, you know, you like the thing that or the reason that I have a seat at the table is because I bring a unique perspective that somebody else in the room cannot bring. And there's a second lesson in that, which is sometimes people are just going to think that you don't deserve your seat at the table. And I think you have to have the self-trust and the self-confidence to say, you know what? That's okay. That's your opinion. And maybe you feel that way. And maybe you're right. But at the end of the day, I believe that I have some value to bring. And, you know, I believe that I actually have something to add or contribute to this environment. So I'd say, like, one, remember that your perspective is the most important thing. And two, sometimes you just got to silence out the haters and say, you know what, you might feel that way, but unfortunately I am here, or fortunately for me, and I do, like, I have self-trust and self-confidence that I'm contributing in an important way.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you are actually contributing in a good way is that you've always been an advocate for including more women into the industry and, you know, for giving more opportunities to female founders, because we have to admit that they do face challenges more than, you know, their male counterparts. So can you tell us, when it comes to the region, about, you know, the unique challenges that female founders face compared to globally? Are they the same? Are there unique challenges that they face, and how are you trying to address that?
Yeah, so in 2020 we ran a really, really interesting set of get-togethers called the Breakfast Series, essentially focused on females in the region and women in tech. And so what we tried to do was, like, we held these small breakfasts where we pulled together two female funders, so investors, two female founders, and two women sort of in larger tech. So that could be somebody who works at Microsoft or someone who works at Google. And essentially what we were trying to get to the crux of was, you know, where is the challenge when it comes to the funnel or, you know, the amount of female founders that are present in the region? One, do they exist? Where are they? Two, if they exist, what are the kind of struggles that they face? And three, how can we obviously enable, you know, corrections in both of those things, which is increasing, like, the top of the funnel and increasing, you know, essentially the number of female founders who, like, make it further down the funding life cycle. And I think the biggest takeaway that we had from that experience is that it's not that, like, you know, from speaking to these, like, diverse groups, and this was over multiple breakfasts with different, you know, sort of test groups or conversations, it's not a one size fits all. People have different challenges, you know, faced, like, based on different things, right? For a lot of, you know, female founders, it's that they don't enjoy access the same way their male counterparts do, right? In terms of access to networks. And, you know, especially for a lot of the female founders who are also, you know, parents and juggling other responsibilities, you know, attending that 5 to 7 p.m. mixer, which is where the industry meets, isn't really feasible when you have, like, you know, a family to manage on top of things, right? So essentially, amongst all the other things that they're juggling, building their company, managing their family, suddenly, like, the environment to, like, participate and network and build relationships isn't, you know, like, feasible for them, quite frankly. And some people said, you know, it was because there is this kind of perception that females work in, you know, or focus on businesses that aren't attractive to venture returns. So there was like many different diverse reasons like why. And I think that, so the biggest takeaway was it's not a one size fits all. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of women said that, you know, we're over mentored and underfunded, which is that people always want to do, you know, some kind of, you know, mentorship program or support program or yeah, some kind of advice. And we've had founders say, trust that I know how to build my business. What I'm really looking for is capital to build it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think that was like another, you know, feedback, which was like creating a lot of these female founder programs. And then also essentially, you know, just like giving female founders your time and giving them business advice isn't necessarily the most useful thing for them. And then I think another piece of that was, you know, people saying that these female founder forums, like while they're a great forum for us to sort of discuss our challenges and speak about, you know, where we're struggling to build our businesses, at the end of the day, any success that we have or any failure that we have then somehow becomes attributed to whether or not, you know, we're a female.
Exactly.
Right? So we get, you know, she is the most...
You don't look at them as like, you know, a business founder rather than a female business
100%.
Founder.
100%. And even that, I was at the time, I'm not sure this is true anymore, I was the youngest partner at a VC firm in MENA. I was not the youngest female partner. I was the youngest partner, full stop. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you use the word female in front of these kinds of conversations, it kind of suddenly makes all that success attributed to that. And I think a lot of female founders shared that sentiment. Mm-hmm. So from our perspective, we do actively like source and we do actively seek to build the funnel of female founders. And we do actively track and re-engage with female founders who we think are really promising. But we continue to and will always assess an investment on the merits of the investment itself, irrelevant of the gender. We do understand there are structural challenges, but like we always want female founders to know we're investing on you based on the merits of your business and what you're building, not because you're a female founder. But we also do understand and take responsibility that we have a job to sort of cultivate and build that top of the funnel.
And speaking of investments, I wanted to actually ask you about it. What do you look at when you are investing or when you choose to invest in a certain company? Is it the founder, the character of the founder, because you believe that this founder actually can do something? Or is it merely the business idea? Or what is it that you focus on most?
Yeah, so we invest at Series A. Global Ventures invests at Series A, which is essentially what we're looking for is founders who have achieved product market fit and that are sort of looking to scale and build upon that proof of concept and that their product is working, right? And because of that, we focus on five characteristics or five focus areas for investments. This can really change depending on the sector and the geography. But broadly, like the five things that we focus on are first the founder. Mm-hmm. And this is the most heavily weighted piece because you know what? At this point, the founder is still very much the captain steering the ship. And, you know, it's very much their idea and sort of them driving the business forward. And so we really need to have complete faith that they are the right person to build this business, right?
Absolutely.
For many different reasons and on many different factors. Mm-hmm. Also, obviously, our chemistry with the founder is really important. You know, understanding of their grit, their resilience, you know, to weather through tough times. But the founder is like the key to success. The second thing that we look at is the addressable market. So essentially, how big is this problem? And, you know, what market could, you know, this founder or this business essentially capture? And what is the value of that market? Like, is this a $1 billion business at the end of the day, right? And sometimes is it a $1 billion business in terms of scale, or is it a $1 billion business in terms of, you know, a niche that people are willing to pay significantly out of pocket for, right? The third thing that we consider is the product. Mm-hmm. And essentially it's like, why is this product going to win the market? And does this product make sense for the addressable market that we've discussed? And how, you know, is it differentiated? Which brings me to the fourth thing that we consider, which is, what are the competitive advantages and what are the barriers to entry in this space? So why does this product, this founder, and you know, this market make sense? How are they capturing the market in a way that, you know, their competitors are not? And what are the barriers to entry or the moats for new entrants to come into the space? And then finally, and this is the least weighted, but still equally important because we are obviously financial investors, is who could we exit this business to? Like, what does a liquidity event look like? So across that kind of spectrum, that's usually like what we consider, with the founder being the most important, to the exit being important, but, you know, much less important.
Absolutely. And, you know, Sasha, every few years we have a certain industry that booms and the entire focus shifts on that industry. Like for a few years back, it was fintech. I think last year it was sustainability. So what do you think is the industry that we need to focus on, or that is under the microscope these days?
So essentially, like, if you look at like the history of how we've rolled out funds, I think it's a good indicator of sectors that are interesting, or spaces that we've looked at that are interesting. So initially we started with fintech, and in that context we see fintech as really like layer one of all innovation, which is, if you can't transact online, then there's not much more you can do. Mm-hmm. And then sort of, you know, we started to think about healthcare, and we started to think about digital health and, you know, how people receive healthcare, the access, quality, and cost of healthcare. And then the pandemic sort of came about, and that re-highlighted globally the challenges in healthcare and like sort of the cracks in the healthcare system. I think that as part of like the next sectors that we're focusing and spending our time on, supply chain tech, is very, very interesting. This is like similarly kind of one of the side effects of the pandemic. You know, we saw this like massive ramp up in, you know, e-commerce. We've seen sort of this, you know, freak out over
the supply chain.
Exactly. Well. You know, freak out around like where the supply chain stopped working, you know, the, linked to many different things. And sort of tandem, like linked to that, is like food security. Mm-hmm. And so for us, agri-tech, you know, we live in a region that's very dependent on imports. And so also, you know, like what are we seeing in the region in terms of like food production, innovation in like supply chain to make sure that we have access to food. And then sort of a third that kind of cuts across that would be sort of energy tech. And what we say when we mean that is, you know, all of these things have to move towards a path to sustainability. Mm-hmm. And so essentially something like, you know, those three things collectively are like, you know, I think some really, really exciting sectors to focus on.
And there is also an area that I know is of interest to you, which is longevity. And, you know, especially in the region. So can you tell us a little bit about that and your perspective when it comes to this idea?
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm very, very passionate about longevity. And I think that, you know, most of my team would argue almost too passionate. But when we first looked at healthcare, right, we looked at it on like really the fundamental payer, provider, patient like nexus, which is the three core key stakeholders. And it was very much about sort of healthcare 1.0, which is like, how do I get healthcare? You know, whether it's primary care, so the first touch point that I have with a doctor, secondary care, so more specialized diagnostics or speaking to specialists, inpatient within a hospital, all the way through to sort of like treatment, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sort of like the historical and legacy way of healthcare, of like looking at healthcare, and like those are the key areas that you focus on. I think that as we look at sort of like what does healthcare 2.0 look like, that first piece, the preventative healthcare piece, becomes really, really important. So I don't know if you know this, but we have the largest burden of non-communicable diseases in the world, in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And that means that that's putting a massive pressure on healthcare systems here. Mm-hmm. When a lot of these illnesses are, you know, easily preventable based on lifestyle changes, wellness. And we have this like massive opportunity here to essentially leapfrog what's happening in more developed markets. So in the US and in Europe, we have disease care markets, which is essentially where people get sick and then the healthcare system tries to treat them. In this market, we have like a very young, fast-growing population. We don't necessarily have like the built-out healthcare infrastructure for disease care. So there's really this massive opportunity to start like looking at more in the preventative space. Like, you know, how do I stop somebody from getting type 2 diabetes, right? It's like are sort of the questions we should be thinking about answering, right? And all of that sort of then like ties into the wider conversation around longevity and around, you know, so, you know, people, you know, the lifespan that people live has increased significantly over the past, you know, 30, 40 years, but the health span hasn't, which means like the number of years that you are alive healthy. And so there's like another conversation and discourse going on around like, how do we improve the quality of your life the longer you live? So I think that there's like massive opportunity for innovation, for tech adoption, to sort of understand also how Gen Z wants to receive healthcare to essentially stop that burden from building up.
And Sasha, speaking of your passion, one of the things that you're passionate about, and through all of the experiences, all the fields, all the companies you worked with, this kind of brings me to my last question, which is, you know, out of all of these experiences, What is it, you know, what kind of a legacy or what kind of an impact would you like to leave out of all the things that you do, or, you know, what kind of mark that you want to actually leave in the region or, you know, in the world?
I think, wow, that's a really big question. but I think I want people to feel like it's possible to tell your story the way you want to tell it. Mm-hmm. And what I mean when I say that is that one of the ways we help tell the story of emerging markets, or I help tell the story of emerging markets, is through venture capital, through access to capital. Mm-hmm. And the thought there being that if companies from this region are successful, they then become the global benchmarks. And then sort of we have a seat at the table, or, you know, a role to play in the global ecosystem, similarly to what we see as, you know, Silicon Valley, which is kind of like, you know, the mecca exactly of investing, exactly, or venture capital, right? And I feel like similarly, you know, people, to your point, might see somebody like me and say, that's not the first person I would think of when I think of a partner in a venture capital firm. So the legacy or the impact I would want to leave is that, you know, especially in the global south, we have the ability and the power to tell our stories the way we want to tell them.
It's absolutely interesting. And I think we can see what you are doing through all of the companies you've helped raise capital, make change. And I think we, like our region or part of the world is picking, you know, the attention. And hopefully we reach a point where we are the benchmark. Thank you so much for being with us, Sash, and for sharing your story and your passion and all the things that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.